Good day and welcome to Letters and Politics. I'm Mitch Jezerich. Today I'm very happy to welcome back to this radio program William Dalrymple. William Dalrymple is historian, curator, broadcaster, and critic. He's the author of a number of books, including his previous one that he joined us to talk about called The Anarchy, The East India Company, Corporate Violence, and The Pillage of an Empire. Today he joins us to talk about the great influence of ancient India. In fact, that is the topic of his book. It's called The Golden Road, How Ancient India Transformed the World. As I said, William Dalrymple, it is a great pleasure, sir, to welcome you back to this program. Thank you for taking the time.
Very nice to be back, Mitch. Thank you so much.
And I should also add, you do a podcast with Anita Anand. I said this before we started. I actually am a listener to the podcast Empire.
That's very good to hear, Mitch. Thank you. And it's all about all empires. So we oscillate between ancient Assyria and modern India, or we're actually just about to start doing all the places that Trump's about to invade. So we're going to do a little series on Greenland, Panama, Gaza, and all the rest of it. So
we Americans, that's how we learn geography of the world.
I think that's how the Imperial Brits learned geography too. Red blobs on the 19th century map. They've probably forgotten it long since now, though.
No, that totally makes sense. I want to get into India because there's a lot to talk about a lot I'm very interested in. And let me just start off by saying, in talking about the Eastern and Western worlds, the way we see Eastern and Western world, in the Western world, we see Greece as sort of the beginning of this Western tradition, something that gave us democracy, philosophy, literature, science, architecture. Greece would influence Rome, and then Rome would go on to influence Europe, as well as Western Asia and North Africa.
And the pillars in front of many of our buildings, including the hotel I'm talking to you from.
The architecture, our neoclassical architecture that we have.
Exactly.
Is how we see Greece to the Western world, how you see India and ancient India to the Eastern world?
Not exactly, in the sense that, you know, there were clearly many places early in man's history that came up with big, profound answers to the fundamental questions that man asked himself. What are we doing here? How do we live a moral life? How do we understand the world we're on? What's the size of this earth? What's the relationship of the earth to the heavens, the moon, the stars? Ancient Greece was one of those. So was ancient China. So was ancient India. The difference, I think, is that the Greek answers to those questions are things that became tom-tommed around the world with the Enlightenment and with colonialism. So most people in most places of the world will be able to tell you these days from the age of 7 or 8, for example, the story of Archimedes in his bath shouting Eureka, or Pythagoras and his theorem, maybe from your 10th or 11th grade maths class. But no one in the West knows the equivalent Indian figures. And to give just two examples, there's these two characters I read about in The Golden Road. One is Aryabhatta, who comes up about 300 AD, which is the golden age of Indian mathematics, with not only his own version of pi, but the exact circumference of the Earth, the exact distance of the Earth to the moon, and the fact that the Earth is heliocentric 1,000 years before Galileo clicks this idea. His successor, Brahmagupta, who's a generation later and takes on his work, comes up with a definition of zero and an understanding that zero is a number rather than just an absence or a placeholder, and builds on that the superstructure of algebra, algorithms, the whole higher mathematics that we then learn, and indeed our number system, because our number system is also from India, though we in the West call it Arabic numbers because we got them from the Arabs, but the Arabs got them from the Indians. And that story of how that happened is an important part of the final section of my book. But I think while, as I say, the Greek answers to these big questions are known universally now around the world, thanks partly to colonialism, and while the Chinese have become fantastically good at telling their story, particularly with this, in a sense, this vehicle of the Silk Road, which is actually not an ancient idea. The Silk Road was an idea that was invented by a German geographer in 1877, a guy called Baron von Richthofen. Those boys listening to this who got excited by their military history will know the Red Baron von Richthofen, who was his grandson of the Flying Circus of the First World War. And not to be confused with Monty Python again, quickly put in there. This idea of an east-west motorway, effectively, which moved silk and other precious goods overland, is an idea which only enters the English language. The Silk Road's first ever expression in English is 1936. And it's only really in the 1980s, with a couple of big shows in the Met and the National Gallery of Art in Washington, that this idea really sort of takes off. But it's now become an unquestioned academic and popular history fact. And indeed, the Chinese have built the Belt and Road on this. And I think there is, thanks to, for example, the two big exhibitions in London last summer, a very well understood basis for China's early primacy, both as a center of trade and the economy, but also as a center of civilization and ideas. For some reason, India is not well known outside India. Every Indian will be able to tell you about Aryabhatta and Brahmagupta. It's an essential part of their curriculum since Indian independence in 1947. So I've tried to lay out how India, first of all, was at the center of the world economy. And my thesis in this book is that in the ancient world, at least, up to the 12th century, which is about the point that, in my view, the Silk Road does begin to take off, after the Mongols smash a hole through the middle of Asia, connecting Mediterranean to the South China Sea. So Marco Polo in 1271 can go from Jerusalem to Xanadu with a phial of oil from the Holy Sepulchre for Kublai Khan. And at that point, there is a motorway. But my thesis is that before that, there wasn't. And that India was actually the main conduit of East-West interaction. And that it was not overland, but by the monsoon sea routes. And India has this extraordinary gift, which no other country has, certainly not my homeland of Scotland, where wind blows crazily in all directions at all times. But India has actually rather surprisingly well-organized wind system, thanks to the fact that Tibet, which is this enormous landmass above India, it freezes over in winter and cold winds blow in, and then it thaws in summer and warm winds blow out. Because of that, we have the monsoon wind system, which blows in one direction for 6 months of the year and blows back again the next six, which has meant that throughout history, Indian sailors have only had to put up a sail. And once they've learnt to surf these terrific winds, which are like sort of turbocharged winds, incredibly powerful meteorological forces, but like a brilliant surfer, a practiced surfer can, you know, use those great winds off those great waves off Hawaii and use them as easily as you or I can use the local freeway or motorway. So Indian sailors learned to build boats that were sufficiently strong to survive the monsoon winds, with incredibly elaborate sail systems which could catch the winds. And that meant they, in just 2 months, they could move from, say, the coast of Kerala in southwest India up to the Roman Empire, which had its border at that point on the Red Sea coast of Egypt. And then they can go to a show in Alexandria, see the pyramids, sell their goods, all the rest of it. And then they've got to be back at the shore of the Red Sea 4 months later to catch the winds heading back again in reverse. So this meant that a merchant could make a round trip to either the Roman world or to China in as little as a single year. And we have absolutely clear and straightforward accounts in classical sources. Like Pliny talks about India being the drain of all the precious metals of the world. Pliny's a surprisingly sort of Trumpian figure. He's very worried about the foreigners selling more than they're getting, and that's certainly the case with India. India was flooding the Roman world with luxuries, with gems, with ivory, with pepper, with cotton and silks. And they were not wanting anything Roman. A small taste for wine, good Tuscan wine, a small taste for garum, which was the Roman fish sauce. But in general, the Indian merchants were just after Roman gold. And you get this massive flood of gold from Rome to India, which in order to control the Romans in a very contemporary move, put 30% tariffs on imports from India. So nothing is new in the world. So we have this very clear evidence of not just one or two brave individuals going where no man has gone before, but massive fleets. Strabo talks about fleets of 120 up to 200 vessels leaving the Red Sea every year when the winds change, and heading in this massive fleet down to the mouth of the Indus and Sindh, which controls, you know, you can punt stuff up all the way into Central Asia and Afghanistan. Gujarat, which services in a sense the Gangetic Plain and the center of Indian civilization, and Kerala in southwest India, which is the richest port of all, where all the pepper is found. And Pliny, again, is rather disapproving of pepper. He regards it as a sort of woke spice that, well, you know, what are all these young liberals doing in Rome, putting this stuff on? And silk, which again, we just think of as a sort of luxury, Pliny thinks of as a sort of, you know, sort of porno promiscuous outfit that liberal women in Rome will insist on wearing to show off their curvy forms. And again, this sort of North Roman naval commander is having none of it. Silk and pepper are foreign, woke, liberal, absolutely not what decent Romans should be engaging themselves in.
I want to ask about the things that India would give to the world, ancient India. And when you mentioned mathematics, which is important, the number zero, and just sort of the foundations of our own mathematical systems today, which you call the closest thing we have to a universal language. Let me ask about another thing, Buddhism.
So I put in the book, in a sense, three sections. And yes, we should talk about all three. I talk about Buddhism. I talk about Hinduism and Sanskrit and that whole baggage of Hindu thought, which is a little bit later. It spreads than Buddhist thought, but is equally important. And then thirdly, the Indian ideas of mathematics and zeros and the number forms, which spread westwards from the 8th century AD onwards. So yeah, Buddhism is the first, and the Buddha, well, is a historical character. We should say that first. He existed as a human being on this earth in the mid 5th century BCE. He is born in a place called Lumbini, which today is just over the Nepalese border from India. He has his enlightenment, his moment of inspiration, if you like, at Bodh Gaya, which is in Bihar now, which, on the Gangetic Plain. And he preaches his first sermon at Sarnath, which is outside Varanasi, Benares in Uttar Pradesh. And to begin with, Buddhism doesn't spread far, oddly. It remains very much for 200 years one of the many competing sets of philosophical ideas in that part of the world. There's some other rival faiths, such as the faith of the Jainism, which is still around in India, but not very well known outside India. And then there are other competing faiths from that period, which have completely disappeared. Something called the Ajivikas, for example, are very prominent at the time of Ashoka, and we have no trace of who they were or what they are today. We just know their name. Then something extraordinary happens. 250 BC, the great early Indian emperor Ashoka, who is the kind of Indian answer to, in some ways, to Alexander the Great. He conquers this enormous empire that embraces three quarters of modern India and all of Pakistan and Afghanistan. Ashoka, guilty about the massive slaughter that he has undergone, directed to his rivals on the east coast of India, the Kalingas, converts to Buddhism. There's some dispute about the chronology, whether he converts before or after this great slaughter, but certainly he explains his missionary fervor to spread nonviolence and Buddhism as related to that terrible slaughter that he was responsible for. And we have this very unusual thing at any period of history where a ruler apologizes and says, I mucked up, and my solution is that you follow me and embrace this new faith, Buddhism, this philosophy of nonviolence, stop eating meat, stop harming your neighbor,
And he stopped harming neighbors.
Stopped harming neighbors, declaring but he war
lived,
on.
And he ruled accordingly?
He lived like that in about 250 BC. And it's interesting, like all states that develop nonviolence, they always have to make some sort of exception in order to keep the ship afloat. So it's very clear that he is employing violence against Aboriginal tribes in the hills who are coming down and raiding, and he says if they will not accept nonviolence, then we will have to make provision. But basically, he embraces nonviolence, he embraces Buddhism, and he sends out what he calls Dharma ministers, by which in our terms is missionaries, and he sends them out not just around modern India, but right out into the Hellenistic world. So remember, this is the period when Alexander's died two generations previously in Babylon. The Hellenistic world is split up. There's Ptolemy now in Egypt. There's Antiochus and Seleucus and all these Macedonian generals ruling great chunks of Asia. And it's into that world that he sends these Dharma ministers. And we get echoes of his thought in various inscriptions, for example, Turkey, with in the Greek, the word Eusebia, which is later a word associated with Christianity, is used rather than Dharma, the central idea of Buddhism of duty and religious duty. But he sends missionaries as far as Cyrene. Can you remember Simon of Cyrene in the Gospels, who plays a part in the Passion story? Cyrene is Libya. So you get Indian missionaries reaching Libya, which is a long, long way from India. And in the 200 or 300 years that follow, one of the great miracles of world history takes place. Buddhism expands out from this very small base in northern India on the plains of the Ganges. And within 200 or 300 years, it spread through what's now Pakistan and Afghanistan to what's now Uzbekistan and Central Asia. It spread through Lhasa and Tibet to Mongolia and even as far as Siberia, which again is, half a world away from India and the opposite climate. It spread again through China to Korea and Japan, and then through Sri Lanka to Burma, Thailand, Vietnam, Laos, Cambodia, and even the Philippines. So it's one of the great non-violent ideological conversions of history.
It spread without violence?
Without any violence. And after the death of Ashoka, really without much state propulsion either. It's traders and the power of ideas. And that's quite rare in history, that ideas are spread by power of, that you have an empire of the spirit rather than an empire of the sword. And so by the time, I suppose, of about 200 or 300 AD, Buddhism is a pan-Asian religion. It gets as far westwards as Persia, and we've begun discovering a few Buddhist heads and statues in Egypt. Only 2 years ago, a wonderful new Buddha head appeared in an Isis temple in ancient Egypt. So it does go west, but its greatest successes are to the east. The imprint of those early Buddhist missionary journeys are there today. When you go to Cambodia or Burma, you see Buddhist monks on every street.
And obviously today it's a global religion. I mean, there's American Buddhism.
See it in California.
There's California Buddhism,
including,
I promise
including
you.
Leonard Cohen, yeah.
One of my favorite stories is about this Chinese monk, Xuanzang, who would travel thousands of miles from China to India to find scriptures that he could bring back. Tell me, who was Xuanzang?
So he's a very interesting character. And what's wonderful about Xuanzang is that in a period of history when we are often scraping around for evidence with a potsherd here, an inscription there, and often, there can be gaps of 100 years between, major sources. Xuanzang suddenly turns up in the kind of mid-660s, and he is this Chinese monk from a very sort of smart intellectual Chinese background who is a Buddhist, and he becomes convinced that the Buddhist sources that all Buddhists are using in China are corrupted, that they're not reliable, and that he's not getting the full truth of his faith. And he makes the decision that the only way he can get that truth is to rely on the protection of the Buddha and head off on foot. In the middle of a civil war in China, through the Taklamakan and the Gobi deserts, over the Himalayas and the Pamirs, and narrowly escapes being sacrificed to the goddess Durga in the Ganges, and makes it to the great Buddhist monastery Nalanda, which is like the Library of Alexandria of the Buddhist world. And where, incidentally, you know, you see a floor plan that's been uncovered by archaeologists. It looks just like, you know, Oxford High Street. You have a whole series of cloisters with a walk around the cloister, and then scholars' rooms on two stories. And I make the case in the book that, in fact, this is the origin of that plan, which, you know, you can see at Harvard Yard, even in North America. And that the intermediary is the madrasa of Islam. Today, madrasas have a very bad reputation as centers of terrorism, and they normally turn up on the news when some terrible atrocity has taken place somewhere. But traditionally, they are just the places of learning of the Islamic world. This floor plan, which starts with the Buddhists, becomes the early Islamic floor plan of scholarly institutions, first in Afghanistan, then Persia, then Cairo and North Africa, and finally in Islamic Spain. And the first universities in the West to adopt that plan are Bologna, Salerno, Palermo, Paris, Oxford, and Cambridge. And so you have these ideas starting in India and reaching, you know, many centuries later. Another idea, incidentally, which came at the same time and by the same route, is chess, originally an Indian idea. And I don't think many of us realize that when we play chess, that we're playing an Indian game and still using the Persian terms. So when we shout checkmate, that's actually, you're speaking Farsi, Shah Mat, the king is dead. I think about probably 1% of chess players realize they're speaking Farsi.
Well, I think the rooks were elephants.
That's right,
and the queen was a minister that only in the original game only moved one square at a time. The game was sped up when the queen. I think it was the Europeans who made it queen.
Exactly right. It's always said. I don't know whether it's true or not, but the story is it's always Isabel of Castile that is the model for the queen on the chessboard. So it moves from being the vizier, who's always the powerful prime minister in the Islamic world, to being the queen. And Isabel of Castile is the, I don't know, the Indira Gandhi or the Golda Meir or the Mrs. Thatcher of the Reconquista of Spain.
You mentioned that, again, this Chinese monk, Zhuangzang, finds and goes to Nalanda's library. I had never heard of Nalanda's library. I was very excited to learn about Nalanda's library. As you described it earlier, this is India's version of the Great Library of Alexandria.
Or, if you like, in the Islamic world, the Bayt al-Hikmah, the House of Wonder in Baghdad a little bit later. Yeah, I mean, again, it's a measure of this sort of weird way in which, for whatever reason, whether it was British colonialism or whether it was just a series of chance failures to propel this idea, that we just don't know the Indian equivalents of the great mathematicians, the great universities, the great libraries. Nalanda was the greatest educational institution in Asia. Not just Xuanzang walks away all the way from China, but we have many other monks in the centuries before and after who walk from Korea, Japan. We even have a foundational, what's called a copper plate, which is a grant set in metal so that it'll be there for posterity.
It's a nine-story structure.
Nine stories, nine-story library. And this foundational plaque that survives has an expatriate college set up with the full endowment by the King of Indonesia. Again, Indonesia is, you know, quite a way from India. But the King of Indonesia donates whatever it is, the revenues of 100 villages, to the monks, so that Southeast Asian monks can participate in this too. So we have not only an educational institution which is highly regarded, but one which is actually visited by an international student body, you know, almost as wide as a modern Oxbridge or Harvard. And it's an extraordinary place. So Xuanzang spends 20 years there. He copies out, over those 20 years, the essential texts. His two things he's interested in. One is the kind of Yogacara texts, which are the highest Mahayana philosophical texts that he believes were dictated by the Bodhisattva Maitreya. And then he's interested in monastic disciplinary texts. So in other words, the sort of the texts which tell you how to run a Buddhist monastery. And he copies those out. And he brings all these texts back on a caravan of horses and pack animals and even some elephants, and gets most of it back to China intact. There's one boat that goes down on the Indus, and he's heartbroken because some of his favorite texts are in that boat. But you know, considering the possibilities for things going wrong between Nalanda and China, he gets 9/10 of his manuscripts back, and they build a library modeled on that of Nalanda in Shang'an, modern Xi'an. It's called the Wild Goose Pagoda and stands to this day. So while we've lost the tower at Nalanda, we've got a big brick tower, but you can't see, you know, what its original form was. You can just see a mountain of brick. If you go to Chang'an, you can see the Chinese copy standing to this day.
And what I love about this story, and you'll correct me if I'm wrong on this, but I want to next move to, because I think you could draw a line from Zhuang Zong coming back to China with these texts, the influence that he would have, the influence that the texts would have on Buddhism and China. And I believe we can draw a line to the rise of Wu Zetian, who would become the first, I guess, sanctioned empress of China.
First and only.
And her story is wild.
It's a great story. So as I said, one of the great things about Xuanzang is that in a period when we have very, very poor sources, we have Xuanzang's own account written on his return, just after he got all these manuscripts back safely to China. And then we have his pupil's account. There's a guy called Hu Li, who's his sort of Dr. Watson, if you like, to the Sherlock of Xuanzang. So we have the disciple's account, and these two texts between them give us more information than we have for almost any other moment of ancient India. They are an extraordinary survival. Suddenly the lights go on. You can see exactly the landscape. They're full. They're discursive. The pupil, Hu Li, is a little bit more inventive, shall we say. There's quite a lot of sort of miracles and things in Hu Li's account. But Xuanzang is very sober and gives a very realist, modern feeling travel account of what it's actually like to, you know, feel footsore in the Himalayas and to be tied up and sacrificed nearly. There's a lovely story with the sacrifice, which I should just tell quickly. It's Durga Puja, which is the big ceremony to this day in Eastern India. And a bunch of pirates capture him, and they're about to sacrifice him when suddenly an enormous squall blows up. And I know this from my farm in Delhi, where I live most of the year. You know, you do get these sudden moments when suddenly the trees shake and a dust storm out of nothing comes. And anyway, Xuanzang is saved by the fact that this happens, and the sailors interpret this as being a divine disapproval. And Xuanzang, who is a sort of very high Buddhist adept, has sent himself into a deep meditation, which he's asked to be let into before he's sacrificed. So he's gone off deep into himself. And eventually one of them taps his shoulder and he says, "Is it time to be sacrificed now?" He's completely unaware that, you know, there's been this enormous, trees have been crashing down behind him and dust has been flying in the air. And the pirates say, no, sir, you're free. You're clearly a great friend of the gods. And he's let off and makes it to Nalanda. Anyway, we're diverting from Wu Zetian, which is this extraordinary story. So he comes back and he finds this improbable ally in a 15-year-old concubine in the imperial harem. And the background to this is that for 300 years, Buddhism has been growing in importance in China. More and more people have been converting to it, both the peasantry and those at court. But it's still regarded as a foreign religion. You know, it's from India. It's not a Chinese religion. And there are those from the Confucian and Taoist world who regard it as a heresy and something which goes against all Chinese principles. For example, you know, one of the things of Buddhism is that you give up your family and you walk out and seek yourself in meditation and suffering. While for Confucianism, the most important thing is to honor your parents and be around to look after them and honor their memory. So there is a fundamental clash between the ideas of the Confucians and the ideas of the Buddhists, which is not bridgeable. Anyway, Xuanzang makes it back. He tries to convert the emperor, whose name is Taizong, who's the great this is the Tang Golden Age, one of the great moments of high imperial Chinese civilization. And according to his own account, he nearly survives, but then he dies just before he succeeds, and his son Gaizong takes over. But Xuanzang has a lucky break in that Gaizong has had an eye on his father's concubine, and at some point, Wu Zetian, this Buddhist beauty, clearly, manages to somehow hop from her father's harem into the son's harem, which goes against every taboo known to man. And yet this improbable sort of hottie, Wu Zetian, becomes the key to the future of Buddhism in China, because she becomes first the empress, then when Gaizong has a stroke, the regent, and then using a sort of think tank of Buddhist scholars called the Scholars of the Northern Gate, she actually converts the state to a Buddhist state, and so this sole one lone Buddhist empress, the only woman ever to rule China in her own right in the whole of Chinese dynastic history, converts the state to Buddhism. It doesn't last long; it lasts for 50 years, but it is, if you like, the high watermark of Buddhist influence in China.
I mean, she sort of had to, right? Because the Confucius weren't going to accept a female empress.
Correct. Confucianism is a very conservative faith. It believes in honoring your father, in honoring the family. And part of that is the patriarchy, looking after the male-dominated world. So it's complete anathema to Buddhists to have a woman running the show.
And she didn't get to
the top.
Sorry,
it's complete anathema to Confucians, yeah, to have a woman running the show. Yeah.
And she didn't get to that position of emperor without having her blood on her own hands.
Yeah. And now it's very difficult to know exactly what happens, because the only accounts we have on her reign are by the Confucians who hated her. Mm. And they turn her into this sort of Lady Macbeth of China, murdering everybody. And this seems genuinely, as far as one can interpret these sources at all neutrally, that there was a considerable, shall we say, a churn of ministers and courtiers, and that many of them either disappear early in their lives or are sent off to exile or clearly dispatched by more violent means. But scholars differ on how far these very acid Confucian revenge takes, if you like, on Wu Zetian after she's gone, how far they can be trusted at all. But yes, it's clearly a period of churn, that the state is, you know, changing its allegiance after 2,000 years of Confucian dominance and Taoist prominence. Suddenly, China's gone over to a foreign faith. It's gone over to Buddhism.
And she would rule for four decades?
She will rule for 10 years as wife and regent, and then 40 years as actual sole command as empress.
And this is during the Tang Dynasty, like I believe the.
An interregnum in the middle, because she actually declares her own dynasty. Okay. She breaks the Tang, and in fact, she massacres a lot of the Tang princes, according to the Confucian accounts.
That's interesting.
But then in the end, her son, who is the son of Gaizong, succeeds and the Tang return to power. But this is a period which is, you know, is notorious in Chinese history. There's a 250-part Chinese soap opera about this on TV with a very gorgeous actress playing Wu Zetian, often surprisingly scantily clad for an early period of history. And in that, she is this vamp, this mega vamp who dispatches lovers and husbands and ministers with unparalleled violence. And I say a lot of these stories are there in the Confucian accounts. The question is whether we can trust them and how far they represent the truth.
I mean, it is interesting to me that Wu Zetian is empress right before the Tang Dynasty. I'm not very good with any of this history, but my understanding of the Tang Dynasty is sort of this cultural high in the history of China. It's where you get the great poets like Li Bai and Tu Fu, and also the scroll paintings, the nature scroll paintings kind of come from.
Now, your understanding is brilliant, but for one thing, that she's in the middle. So it's found her original boyfriend, if you like. She's age 15 in the harem of Taizong, who's the founder of the Tang Dynasty.
Yeah.
And then she nearly, you know, she nearly ends the Tang. She declares her own dynasty. So it would have been that the Tang was just one or two, one and a half generations. But then her son succeeds and restarts the Tang. So, her period is a period of great cultural achievement. And we have these incredible images from just outside Xi'an, one of which, the universal Buddha, Buddha Vairocana, is supposedly modeled on her own features. So we have a massive Mount Rushmore scale image of the Buddha in this sort of strange female form.
Do you think her reign and power, that period of time, is a precursor to this sort of cultural artistic revolution that China?
Not a precursor, it's part of it.
Part of it.
I mean, it starts before her and it in no way pauses during her reign, but it is centered on Buddhism during her reign. So we get these amazing cliff monasteries outside Shagan and Luoyang and some of the greatest sculptures ever carved in China. But the important point is that it is under the influence of India, and never again will India be so powerfully inspirational at the heart of Chinese life and art.
I've always been really interested in thinking about things in the ancient world coming from India to China. I've always been fascinated by the story of Kuan Yin, the Chinese Bodhisattva of compassion, who came from India, who in China, Kuan Yin is a female figure. Many people have tattoos of Kuan Yin on them today. Even here in the United States, I see them regularly around. A very popular figure in China. But Kuan Yin comes from Avalokitesvara.
Who's a male.
Who's a male. And a male deity. And everyone seems to believe it's the same deity or the same bodhisattva of compassion. But I've always wondered about what going from India to China, what did that say about how Avalokitesvara becomes Kuan Yin?
So I think the process is the fact that bodhisattvas are often depicted deliberately asexual. So the many images of Avalokitesvara in his male form are emphatically feminine in their sort of form. I mean, to go into the, if you want the full details, one of the marks of a Buddha is retracted genitals. So you never see the Buddha with his male features. That's actually part of Chinese scripture. So you have a feminized figure of Avalokiteshvara that's arriving in China. And I presume, and this is just me interpreting rather than having a firm factual handle on this, but I presume that at some point someone made an error and thought it was a woman, because some of the even in India, if you go to the Ajanta caves, the beautiful Padmapani, who's a form of Avalokiteshvara. Padmapani means the form that holds the lotus. Padma is lotus. That is, you know, it's not a woman, because in Indian art, women are shown always with very voluptuous figures, but it is a feminized, a very feminized male form of beauty. You're absolutely right. It's a fascinating moment, and it happens exactly this in the early Tang, that you get this strange sex change of the Bodhisattva.
Now, of course, China is an ancient civilization too, and in the years you're really focusing on are sort of the rise of Ashoka, 250 BCE to about 1200 AD. Before, I mean, is China influential to India?
Yes, but not as much. And that's quite an important point. I mean, there are many, many Chinese inventions. China, as we know, is the source of many of the most extraordinary leap forwards in world history: paper, watermills, porcelain, gunpowder, being just a few examples. And quite a lot of those make their way to India. But it's not the same as an entire philosophical system taking over another country. And I think it's very important to emphasize that when Buddhism takes over China, we're not just talking, you know, mantras and a few monks in monasteries. We're talking an entire conception of the universe, the conception of time. Time is a circular being, the idea of the world being centered on Jambudvipa, which is the kind of Chinese-Indian landmass, that bit of Eurasia is the center of the world. And so along with Pali and Sanskrit, these languages arrive with the whole body of Indian literature. And you know, embedded in all those texts that Xuanzang brings back for the Wild Goose Pagoda is an Indian view of the world. So it's an unequal relationship. And Xuanzang says somewhere in his text, which I have at the, I think the opening lines of my book, in fact, let me read. It says, "People of distant places with diverse customs generally designate the land they most admire as India." Now, for a Chinese scholar to write that, that's quite something, because as we know, throughout history, China has been a place that is so sure of its own cultural superiority that they've had very little interest in other countries, as, for example, the British discovered in 1789 when they send their first mission to Beijing. And the Macartney mission, which incidentally I've just been talking about in my podcast, Empire, we talk about this. The Brits go to incredible efforts at a time when, you know, the Brits tend to regard other peoples rather in the Chinese fashion as sort of below contempt. The Brits spend 5 years gathering, the fanciest planetarium, hot air balloons, anything they think that will dazzle the Chinese, a whole load of telescopes, state-of-the-art 18th century telescopes. And the Chinese emperor is shown these, and he merely replies, "We have no need of these childish knickknacks." So this moment when Indian civilization takes over China is a highly significant moment. But what's important is it's not the only part of the world that's going under Indian influence at this point. At the same time as this is happening, Hinduism, ideas of Hindu kingship, and the Sanskrit language is becoming in Southeast Asia the dominant form of polity. So all the local tribal kings of Southeast Asia, with their often situated on the estuaries of these big rivers like the Mekong, which stretch into the interior of Southeast Asia, they are converting to Hinduism. And in one generation, you get a guy called Kodunga, for example, who becomes Suryavarman, protected by the sun, protected by Surya in Sanskrit. And all these guys embrace a whole conception of kingship taught to them by the Brahmins, who are the intellectuals and the administrators of the kingdoms in India. And these guys ship over the sea, arrive in Southeast Asia, are awarded with wives and great estates, and basically teach the kings of Southeast Asia how to run their kingdoms on the basis kingdoms are run in India. And the Sanskrit language at this point is, which was originally a sacred language used only for religious ritual, becomes the diplomatic language of Asia. And from Kandahar in Afghanistan to Bali in Indonesia, Sanskrit is what I suppose Latin is in the medieval West, or what Persian is later in a later period of history, or what French is in 19th century Russia. It's the language that all educated people speak and they use to communicate with each other. And the Southeast Asians aren't just sort of provincial copiers of India. They build bigger Indic monuments than the originals in India. So Borobudur is the most elaborate Buddhist monument in the world. It's in Java. Angkor Wat is the largest Hindu temple in the world, and it's in Cambodia. And indeed, the Khmer Empire, I think you could argue, clearly is the largest and most military powerful Hindu empire ever. And it's not in India. So there's a major transformational, astonishing move of Indic art, philosophy, dance, literature, science, and mathematics all the way east. And what's fascinating and what we often forget is that this, particularly the mathematics, also travels east. And there is a moment in 776 when an embassy from a Hindu kingdom in Sindh, in what's now, I suppose, Pakistan, heads to Abbasid Baghdad. Remember, the Baghdad of the Arabian Nights, founded in the 8th century, is then the biggest city in the world. The Arab rulers, the Abbasids, who control Baghdad, control all the way to the borders of Islamic Spain in the west, to the Indus on the east. And the viziers at this period are a family called the Barmakids, who had been Buddhist abbots, who convert to Islam. but who retain their literacy in Sanskrit and their understanding of Indian mathematics. And they call for this embassy in 776, which arrives with the works of these brilliant Indian mathematicians, Aryabhatta and Brahmagupta. And a generation later, a brilliant translation of these two texts into one with a little bit of Euclid added, a little bit of Ptolemy, a little bit of Greek mathematics. And that is done by a man called Al-Khwarizmi. And the book is called, it has a hell of a title, a mouthful in English, even worse in Arabic. It's called the Compendious Book of Hindu Calculation According to Hindu and Balancing. And because it's such a mouthful, even then, it's just known by a nickname, which is Al-Jabr.
Yeah,
algebra. Our word algebra. And yeah. Al-Khwarizmi, who comes up with this, is the basis of our word algorithm.
Yeah. Well, one last question on mathematics, because I did want to ask this. We're almost out of time, but Brahmagupta comes up with the number zero. And again, the Islamic caliphates, these early Islamic caliphates are worth its own show and by themselves, because not just Indian knowledge, but also Western, Greek,
correct,
Roman knowledge comes through
and these caliphates. Ancient Egyptian and ancient Persian. That's the great thing about these Arab worlds, is that it's not so much that they invent anything new, that they bring together for the first time all the knowledge systems of the ancient world.
Yeah, really fascinating stuff. But I did want to ask about the significance of Brahmagupta coming up with the number zero. Why does that matter?
So Brahmagupta's quite a guy. He's sitting on a mountain in Mount Abu and meditating on this profound Hindu and Buddhist concept of sunya, the void, which is at the center of both religions. He realizes that zero, which has been around as a sort of placeholder, but as a just an absence rather than something in itself, he realizes that zero is a number like any other with its properties. And he comes out with a list of 40 properties of zero. For example, it is what you get when you subtract a number from itself. And he comes up with 40 of these, and that gives zero its power. That gives zero. That means that zero is not just an absence. It is a positive force in mathematics with its own properties, and that allows you to do what Al-Khwarizmi later calls completion and balancing. In other words, algebra. It allows you to do binary. It allows you to do the decimal system: tens, hundreds, thousands, tens of thousands, and he and Aryabhatta between them come up with this system of nine numerals and zero by which you can write any number up to infinity with just nine symbols and zero. And that is a massive conceptual leap for mankind. It's one of the great ideas that man has ever had. And as you said at the beginning of this show, it's the number system, which then spreads to the Arab world. Today is arguably the nearest thing we have to universal language. I should just say quickly how it gets to the West, because there's a 400-year gap then. This system spreads throughout the whole Arab world. Everyone from Islamic Spain to Islamic India is using this system. But of course, the Europeans sitting in Northern Europe are still doing MCV, XV1, and CCM, XV. Try doing your long multiplication with Roman numerals, and you'll see how you've got your work cut out. And then in the 12th century, an extraordinary thing happens. The Pisans, as in the Leaning Tower of Pisa, the Italian port and city-state, found a trading colony in Algeria called Bujaya. The guy who runs the trading colony brings his son, and the son goes to the local school, learns Arabic, and learns Al-Khwarizmi's mathematics, which is the basic text taught to teenagers all over the Arab world by this stage. He then goes back to Pisa, where he finds that everyone's still struggling with MCXVM and all that sort of stuff. And so he writes a book called the Liber Abaci, which explains what he calls the modus indorum, the Indian method, to Europeans. And that guy is Fibonacci. And Fibonacci is taken up by the Holy Roman Emperor, Frederick II, who goes to visit him in Pisa and makes this the system. And that, in time, leads to the great Italian banks like the Medici banks. It leads, for example, to the painter Piero della Francesca writing three mathematical treatises, which explain perspective and is the basis of Renaissance painting. And then in a lovely final leap, when Piero dies, his mathematical texts are taken by his friend Fra Luca Pacioli to Milan, where he shares it with his flatmate, who is a painter who is currently working on a Last Supper in Milan. And that is Leonardo da Vinci. So you have this lovely five-leap process by which Leonardo to Fibonacci, Fibonacci to Al-Khwarizmi, Al-Khwarizmi to Brahmagupta, Brahmagupta to Aryabhatta. And that way, the ancient Indian numbers, philosophy, and ideas of mathematics, which in Sanskrit is called Jyotisa, the science of numbers, spreads from ancient India to Renaissance Italy, giving us Leonardo da Vinci and ultimately helicopters, I suppose. The trouble is, the next thing that happens is it goes to England and it becomes the East India Company. So so India's set back by that.
Oh, my
in
goodness.
No uncertain time.
Come here. Roosters came home. They come home to roost.
Sadly so, yeah.
William Dalrymple has been our guest. Again, he is the author of the book, The Golden Road, How Ancient India Transformed the World. William Dalrymple, I've enjoyed our conversation very much, and I thank you.
Thank you, Mitch. It's been great fun.
That does it for Letters and Politics. The show is produced by Deanna Martinez. Kristen Thomas is the engineer. Special thanks to the KPFA social media team. You can find archives of our program online. Just go to kpfa.org and look for Letters and Politics. I'm Mitch Jezerich, and I thank you for listening.